This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our most interesting program today was entitled Consent Decree, Yes or No. Our panelists included Kevin Graham, the head of the Chicago FOP, who said he's against the decree, and the cost to taxpayers will be millions and millions of dollars, he said. Also on our panel, Lori Lightfoot, mayoral contender, said we will need court oversight and that she approves of the consent decree. She started off by saying the city has spent over $500 million in the last 7 years to pay for allegations of police misconduct. Our third panelist was John Escalante, currently the chief of police at the Northeastern Illinois University in the north side of Chicago, but he had been the first deputy superintendent and acting superintendent when present superintendent Eddie Johnson went in for his kidney operation. He said in some ways the consent decree is not needed, that the Department of Justice and COPA and the police accountability reports have not given the Chicago Police Department enough credit for major accomplishments. Kevin Graham said the city shouldn't have to agree to pay settlements so quickly. Lori Lightfoot said they have to do that or else the cost will be even greater. All agreed that the consent decree agreed to by the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, Lisa Madigan, Illinois Attorney General, the major job will be to get a message that is perceived equally by the Chicago Police Department and the community. All the panelists agreed that documents will not change the hearts and minds of people and that the decree will not reduce crime. Lori Lightfoot said that Chicago faces a public health crisis in many communities, and the consent decree will not bring new jobs, new social service providers, new education, new medical care, and will not end gang conflicts. All these issues will have to be addressed by whoever becomes the mayor in the next mayoral election. There have been some cities where the consent decrees have proven beneficial. The panelists mentioned Los Angeles and Seattle, but many other cities have struggled, including Cleveland, New Orleans, Detroit, and Baltimore. The big problem, according to Lori Lightfoot, is that the union in Chicago, the FOP, has opposed everything. Kevin Graham said officers fear the decree because they don't recognize the difference between an honest mistake and misconduct. All agreed that misconduct cannot be tolerated. They all ended up by saying this will be very costly in terms of dollars to the city of Chicago. And where will the money come to enforce the decree? For example, if one of the recommendations is that one sergeant be assigned for every 10 police officers in the city of Chicago by January of 2020, this could mean an outlay of up to $40 million. There are no federal or state funds for this. The citizens of Chicago will pay for the bill.
Good afternoon. How's everyone? Okay. Our panelists, would you please come up as well? I want to thank Dr. Mazur and Jay and the City Club. This organization and these events are always very timely, very important for our city. And this event today is no exception. As you noticed in the newspapers today, there was mention of some developments with the consent decree. And so we're going to talk about those things and more. So while they're getting seated, I am delighted to lead the Safer Foundation. And, you know, we have the opportunity to kind of sit on both sides of the aisle. We work with law enforcement. We operate two minimum security prison facilities. We work very closely with the Chicago Police Department on the gang intervention program. But we also advocate for people with criminal records to make sure that the barriers they face to keep them from becoming productive, law-abiding citizens are eliminated, and that they can get an opportunity for a second chance, take care of themselves and their families in legal ways, which is very important for all of us. So today on our panel, we have three individuals who have been very close to the topic at hand. I'd like to introduce Kevin Graham. Kevin is the president of Fraternal Order of Police Lodge No. 7. He began his career in law enforcement in 1983 working as an officer and detective. He has worked his entire career as a patrolman at the Chicago Police Department before being elected president of the Fraternal Order of Police. Mr. Graham has earned degrees in law enforcement, public administration, holds a master's degree in public policy from Northwestern University. Why don't you give him a hand? We have Mr. John Escalante, former interim superintendent of the Chicago Police Department. He was named in 2016 police chief at Northeastern University, Northeastern Illinois University. Mr. Escalante spent 30 years with the Chicago Police Department. He started as a patrolman, worked his way up to the top, served as interim superintendent from December 1st, 2015 to March 28th, 2016. Why don't you welcome Mr. John Escalante. And our third panelist is Ms. Lori Lightfoot. Ms. Lightfoot is an announced candidate for mayor of Chicago. She has served as a federal prosecutor, a corporate attorney, and served in a variety of leadership roles in the city of Chicago government. From 2015 through 2018, Ms. Lightfoot served as president of the Chicago Police Board. She also chaired the mayor's task force on police accountability, which issued a comprehensive report and recommendations regarding problems within the Chicago Police Department. So welcome, Ms. Lori Lightfoot. So we have a number of questions that we'll pose to all of them to answer, some specific questions for each of them. I'm hoping, if possible, if we can limit the responses to a couple of minutes, and that would give us a chance to get through a number of questions. I probably have 10 audience questions already and more coming. So I just want to warn you, I brought my wife because she raised 4 kids. And when things get out of hand, if you see a shoe raise up in the air, she can throw a shoe across the room with pinpoint accuracy. So if you see that shoe, just want to give you fair warning. So at the end, we'll do audience questions, but let's get started. Most of us, I think, know about the consent decree. Today, of course, you saw there was a decision agreement to have the police officers report when they point a gun at individuals. That was kind of one of the final sticking points. Now, the city and the attorney general's office will submit their final recommendation to the judge, who has indicated that he's going to open some public comments and have public hearings on the 24th and 25th of October. And then, assuming the judge accepts the consent decree, it would move forward. That consent decree, in case people don't know, covers a number of things: use of police, use of force and force reporting, community policing and impartial policing, accountability and transparency, staff recruitment, hiring and promotions, training and supervision, officer wellness, crisis intervention, data management, the independent monitor, and implementation and enforcement. So, consistent with the theme of today, for each of you, we'll start with Mr. Graham. Are you for or against the consent decree? And please explain the reason for the position you've taken.
Sure. Thank you. First of all, I am against the consent decree. Number one, it's not needed. This is a cost to taxpayers that's going to run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Everything that can be done by negotiating between the FOP, the City of Chicago, and the Chicago Police Department. The reforms that are needed are not needed by a federal judge. We are in court today in front of Judge Dow asking for a stay on the very order that Lisa Madigan put out yesterday. We are also in federal court and the appeals court because we believe and we are on very solid ground that we can intervene on this matter. I think we have a very solid case, and the reason that we don't want the taxpayers to have to pay a bill that can be done without this is because a lot of this money can be put in other places. We certainly need a new police academy. We certainly need some things that the police department is in desperate need of. And I believe that reasonable people can sit down and work those things out.
Ms. Lightfoot?
Well, it's very clear that we need court oversight to get the job done that needs to reform our police department. And frankly, I'm disappointed in the comments that Kevin just made, with due respect. The notion that this is costing taxpayers too much, I would love for the FOP to stand up and talk about the fact that we've spent almost $500 million in the last 7 years on settlements, judgments, and attorney's fees that we go into the market and borrow to pay for allegations of police misconduct. So that money, please don't interrupt me. I appreciate you letting me say my point. That money is taxpayer dollars that we are wasting because there's no sense of urgency around police accountability. And I for one, don't agree that this can be easily negotiated between the parties, because if it could be, it would have been. The notion that we are going to allow all of these issues, which frankly, many of which fall outside of the collective bargaining agreement, to go to interest arbitration behind closed doors for somebody who doesn't even live in Chicago to perform oversight, that's not going to happen. And it shouldn't happen. We need this consent decree. I've put out a very specific, detailed critique of it, but we absolutely need it. And it has to be with court oversight and be transparent.
Mr. Escalante.
Thank you. So I can speak to going back to when I left in September of 2016, and I had gone back to being the first deputy superintendent. Going back to then, I don't believe that a consent decree was needed. And I'll say that because I do believe that the Chicago Police Department, starting in December of 2015, had taken a lot of steps to try to improve how we operated and who we were as a department. And I don't think the department was given proper credit in either the Police Accountability Task Force report or the Department of Justice report. If you were to go back and look at a lot of those recommendations of changes that they thought needed to be made, a lot of those came directly from the Chicago Police Department. They came from the boots on the ground, the rank-and-file police officers who were very open and honest with the interviews, all the way up to the command staff. And that included everything from the purchasing of tasers to doubling for 2016 our crisis intervention training, to announcing in January that we were going to be adopting de-escalation training, to expansion of body cameras, to even telling both entities that we were going to rename and redo the community policing. We were going to get rid of CAPS. So if you go back and you look at those reports, a lot of those recommendations are in there, but I don't really believe that the Chicago Police Department ever got credit for the amount of cooperation they gave both to the task force and Department of Justice. Now, I apologize because I hate to give answers where it sounds like I'm sitting on the fence. I'm saying I went back to 2016, and when I left, I don't believe a consent decree was needed. Where we are today, I've obviously been at Northeastern, and I enjoy my job there, so I've only followed now what happens in the media. Though I still talk to my good friend, Superintendent E. Johnson, on occasion, I'm not talking to him about the consent decree. So I do understand, though, from the community perspective, having been the interim superintendent in the wake of the release of the Laquan McDonald video, and having gone to, I can't even count how many community meetings, and hearing from them, their belief that they were not being policed as the rest of the city. I do understand why the superintendent and the Chicago Police Department felt it would be in the best interest of the department and the city to enter the consent decree. But going back to when I left, again, I'll just say no, I don't think at that time that it was needed.
Mr. Graham, I'd like to rebuttal
on that.
What?
Yes. A couple of things. First of all, when Ms. Lightfoot made her comments, she said she wanted me to stand up and explain that. So I said I certainly would. I certainly wasn't interrupting you. I was answering your question. Now, two things. One is the city shouldn't have paid out on many of those claims, and we went to the city council and asked them not to do that. You also made a statement that I don't live in the city. That is a lie. I certainly do live in the city and have lived in the city all this time. Certainly there was an investigation done, and that is unfair for you to say something like that, and you know it's not true.
Well, I don't think I've said that. I think that was the Inspector General's office that found that you lived outside.
No, that's not true.
That's not my business.
That's
between you and the IG.
Okay. Next question. Why do you think the city of Chicago and the police department agreed to negotiate a consent decree? So what was the rationale for that? So, Lori, let's start with you.
I can't speak for the city of Chicago, but I think that the need was obvious. You have two reports that provide pretty detailed findings about deficiencies in the way that the police department had conducted its business, the fractured relationship between the police and the community, and frankly, the lack of investment in its most important asset, which is its officers. That's detailed in bold relief, both in a police accountability task force report, as well as in the Department of Justice report. And Mayor Emanuel, when he stood with Loretta Lynch on January 13th, 2017, committed to do that. Okay. And then a week later, when the world changed, in a lot of profound ways, he backed away from that. But the need was clearly there, and frankly, I'm thankful for Lisa Madigan and her team for filing the lawsuit and compelling the city to negotiate a good, fair deal to transform the police department.
Mr. Escalante, why do you think the city agreed to negotiate?
Well, again, I can only speculate, you know, from how I've followed it. And I hesitate. I don't think it's the right term when it's called, and I've heard it referred to as a voluntary consent decree that the city is negotiating, because it was voluntary after the Attorney General wanted to move forward with her lawsuit. So volunteering to do something after you're threatened with a lawsuit or served with a lawsuit, to me, isn't a volunteering. But I do understand there are certain communities in the city that really have a strong opinion. They're very vocal. They were in 2015. They are today, that they don't feel that they have been treated fairly by the police for decades. I understand that. And I do believe that I think the superintendent, as well as the mayor, saw this as an opportunity to bring great changes to the Chicago Police Department, although it is going to come at a significant cost. But ultimately, I believe their goal was to get the trust of the entire city.
Yeah. Mr. Graham, what's your opinion?
First of all, the accountability report, one of the problems with that is that it said that there was a code of silence. Now, I've been a police officer for more than 30 years, and I don't know of any. And if somebody knew that there was a code of silence and was covering up crimes, then they should have taken an active inference, and they should have moved ahead with that and had somebody investigate it. That didn't happen. Now, that's one of the problems. The other problem is that the Department of Justice did a report. It was a cookie-cutter report of what had gone on all around the country just so they could get a consent decree. Jeff Sessions came in the new Department of Justice and said, we are not going to be following through on that. And there was a number of problems with it. They wanted a collaborative effort to try and work out the differences and not have a consent decree, because they knew it was too expensive for the municipalities and it didn't achieve the goals that they were looking for. Okay. Then Lisa Madigan came in, and we certainly know where that has gone.
Mr. Escalante, how will the existence of a consent decree, assuming that it's adopted, change policing in Chicago?
I think that's a good question, and I think that's going to be something that is going to take some time. I mean, it's going to have to be that annual review, as it is referred to in the consent decree, all the way 3, 4, 5 years down the road. We're going to have to wait to see the effects of the consent decree. I think part of it, how effective it can be with the Chicago Police Department, part of it is going to be dependent on the Chicago Police Department to message it correctly and to get the community to understand what it is and to make sure that it's also messaged correctly through the media. Because if it's portrayed as a decree that's punitive against the entire Chicago Police Department, against all 12,000 sworn members, that's going to be hard to overcome. If there's a way to get the officers and the citizens of the city of Chicago to maybe understand that this is an opportunity to improve, because I don't think I am misspeaking when I talk. Anybody here in this room probably says there's always things you can improve individually and within your organization. So it's part of it is going to be about messaging and how it's received by the department and how it's perceived by the citizens. It's going to take a couple of years, I think, to see how effective it will be.
Ms. Lightfoot, will the consent decree improve community police relations in Chicago?
The document on its own, no, of course not. What needs to be done is actually a real commitment that I think Superintendent Johnson started from the day one that he became superintendent, but it has to be deeper and it has to continue. We really need to get to a point in local policing in our city where line officers believe that respectful, constitutional engagement with members of the public is the most powerful tool that they have. Mm-hmm. Without that, and without bridging that divide and providing legitimacy so that people all over the city truly believe that public safety is available to them and that the police are there on their side, until that day happens, we can have the best document in the world, but it's not going to change hearts and minds. So I think, as John has said, we have to get to a place where the reality matches up with the perception. And I just want to build on one point that John said. He said that there's a perception of unfair treatment in certain neighborhoods in our city. Well, the fact of the matter is, the reality is borne out in the data that the police department itself keeps. For example, in 2014, there was an outsized number of stops all over the south and the west sides that was inconsistent with any, frankly, legitimate policing strategy. And until the ACLU, and I'm pointing to one of the lawyers that frankly led that effort, until the ACLU came in and threatened a lawsuit, that stop and frisk treatment that literally stopped every person who was black or brown, regardless of circumstances, that didn't change. And that has done, frankly, a world of problems and hurts that we are going to be living with as a community for the foreseeable future. So we've got to rethink that relationship.
Mr. Graham and Mr. Escalante, as both members of the police department, will the consent decree help or hurt the effort to reduce crime and violence in the city?
Well, I think it's going to hurt it. When you put more and more restrictions on the police, which we've seen over the last few years, what is going to happen is that the police are going to be disengaging with the public. And that is the absolute opposite of where we need to be. I made suggestions when I first met with Superintendent Johnson that said that on Sunday mornings, I believe our officers should be stopping in at churches, places where people don't feel threatened by the police coming in, places where people can re-engage with the police and have a dialogue. And that was a place to start building that. Mm-hmm. The common sense approach still works. There is ways to achieve what we need to do. And having a federal judge say that this is going to happen at the Dirksen Federal Building is not going to achieve what we need to do.
Mr. Escalante?
As far as the impact the consent decree would have on violent crime, I would say this. Obviously, in theory, the consent decree is meant to make a more professional department, a more diverse department, a department that represents the entire city and has the trust of the city. That is what its intention is. And again, it's going to be years before we see whether or not that actually bears fruit. However, here's what the consent decree is not going to do. In communities that are impacted by high levels of crime and have for decades been impacted by high level of crime, here's what the consent decree is not going to do. It's not going to bring in new jobs. It's not going to bring in new social service providers. It's not necessarily going to improve the education. It's not going to improve their medical care. It's not going to eliminate decades and decades of historic gang conflicts. It's not going to cure those socioeconomic factors that have impacted certain communities in the city for decades. So that's the consent decree is not going to help with. Those issues are going to have to be addressed, not just by the next mayor, but the city as a whole, because you can't put it just on the police. And you can't just put it on the mayor. But those socioeconomic issues are going to have to be addressed if you really expect to have an impact on crime.
Ms. Lightfoot, what impact will Rahm Emanuel's decision to not run for reelection have on the consent decree and this process that's underway?
Well, I think it'll make it easier to get to the finish line, frankly. I think today's announcement that finally the city had dropped its objections to documenting when officers point their guns is, I think, the first indication of that. But I want to pick up on the point that you were making before, which is, look, folks, in violence in the city, we are facing a public health crisis. What's happening are communities that are in distress, and I think John absolutely hit the nail on the head. We have got to have a strategy for violence that also gets at, and first and foremost gets at, the root causes. When we've got neighborhoods where scores of our children live in poverty, we've got unemployment that is off the charts, even in this time of technical full employment in our country, when we've got no jobs, when we don't have good quality neighborhood schools, where we've got medical, mental health, food, and on deserts in neighborhoods throughout our city, the police department can't and shouldn't be the responsibility to be the social services provider for all of those issues. That has got to be something that the mayor of a city sees and takes advantage of and has a comprehensive plan to address. There's other things that we need to do about violence, but first and foremost, we've got to treat it as a public health crisis so that we can identify the root causes and then attack those accordingly.
Mr. Graham, as you've looked at the consent decree in its current form, are there elements in that document that would actually benefit police officers in Chicago?
Sure. What are
some of those
elements? One of the areas is that they plan to expand the CIT officers.
And what is CIT?
The crisis intervention. These are people who deal with citizens who have mental challenges, who may not be on their meds, and I believe that's a extremely positive approach. I can't wait to get to that during our negotiations in the contract, because I am for that. We do not want to fill up our jails with people who simply need a little bit of help, and that they are they need to have their medications, and that's just one element. Also in the training, we need a new facility for training. If anybody thinks we don't need a new police academy, go and take a look at 1300 West Jackson. Now, that is not specifically in this, but it does talk about training, and that is one of the things that is going to be needed in the future.
Mr. Escalante, and I'll ask Ms. Lightfoot, from your experience and your research, do consent decrees work? Has the establishment of a consent decree improved policing in other cities where they've been implemented?
Well, from the research that we've done, they can work. I think LAPD is probably the gold standard. Following the Rampart scandal there, the mayor and members of the community decide, and the superintendent of the police decided that they were going to take this opportunity for a consent decree and transform the department and, frankly, transform the way in which policing services are administered throughout the city. And LAPD is now, I think, the gold standard that's come out of that process. There are other communities that, frankly, haven't taken advantage of the opportunity, and they've struggled. For example, Cleveland has been in a consent decree twice. So has New Orleans. So it really all depends upon the civic leadership, starting with the mayor, starting with a team of people who come together that recognize that they're not going to waste and squander the opportunity to really transform the department. And frankly, in those cities, the union, unlike here, has gotten on board and become a helpful and contributing partner to transforming the police department, because it's in the best interest of their officers. But here we have a union that has opposed everything. So the jury's out, but I'm hoping, frankly, we have a new mayor who recognizes this opportunity and moves forward to really transform policing and, frankly, uplift and strengthen the quality of policing by really supporting our officers, but also bridging the divide between the police and the community.
Mr. Escalante, your response to that question?
Yeah, I'll have to agree with a couple of those points. Specifically, it is hit and miss in some departments. LAPD has been recognized for how well they handled the consent decree. Seattle is another department that has done really well with a consent decree that they went under in 2012. But there are other departments that struggle with it. New Orleans definitely has struggled with the consent decree. Cleveland, Detroit, Baltimore right now, they are they are not being proactive, and a lot of the officers have been saying that they are not being proactive because they are fearful of what will happen if they do something wrong under a consent decree. And so that's why I mentioned earlier, part of it is the messaging, that it's not punitive against 12,000 members of the Chicago Police Department. The other thing that we've got to make sure officers understand as part of a consent decree, and this goes back to, I said this back in 2015, and I know Superintendent Eddie Johnson still says the same thing, that there is a difference between an honest mistake and misconduct. And when an officer makes a mistake out in the field, we address that through training. Sometimes it might be a minor disciplinary issue, but there are differences between how we handle an honest mistake versus misconduct. And misconduct can't be tolerated. But you have to go and look at each individual department that have been under consent decrees to see those that have succeeded and why, and those that have struggled and why.
You know, each of you can answer this question. Assuming this consent decree moves forward, is there anything in its present form, any single thing that you would say really, really needs to change?
I'll start off with saying that part of the problem that the FOP has not been supportive of is that each and every movement has excluded the FOP, and including us having a voice in this consent decree. Part of the problem was that Lisa Madigan's people went directly to our members without talking to us first. They called our members down to headquarters not knowing what they were going to be asked, and our members were very leery because we weren't there to explain anything because nobody had talked to us. We have been excluded from the entire process other than the carve-out language. And we have tried very hard to work with everyone, and it hasn't worked.
Is there something in the current consent decree that you would change?
I would actually toss out the entire consent decree.
Okay.
I don't think it has. But as you go through, and I do have it here, and there was, and when I was making notes, and this is why I say this, it continually excludes us from process. But one of the big problems is that it tries to circumvent the collective bargaining agreement. And that's a big problem. These officers have rights. And it seems that this consent decree wants to address everybody's rights in the city except the men and women who are going out there putting their lives on the line every single day.
Well,
that's a problem.
Mr. Graham, I do believe that the consent decree does speak to the fact that you cannot overstep any rights that the members of a collective bargaining organization have. So,
well,
I don't.
I can answer that part of that, and part of that is okay. They are in front of a judge right now, asking for to have paperwork filed every time officers point their guns. The discipline in that, the impact of that, must be negotiated under Illinois law. They haven't come to us and even talked to us about it. Yeah. So I disagree with that.
Well, I don't think you're going to lose the opportunity to negotiate those things. So that's my reading of it. But Ms. Lightfoot, anything that you would change?
Well, I have to first address the comments that Kevin just made. I'm not the parties, but I believe that the FOP was reached out and tried to be brought into the process from day one. So the notion that the leadership hasn't been talked to, hasn't been dressed, hasn't had an opportunity to weigh in, I just think that that's false. Number two, if you look at the actual content of the consent decree, there's loads of things in here that are intended to uplift the quality of life of officers every single day. One of the things that you didn't mention, but I will, is an officer wellness program. We all know that officers face trauma every single day. For the first time, the department is getting serious about expanding the number of EAP counselors and other cert offerings for officers so they can deal with the stress on the job.
Okay.
And to your question, there's a number of things that, frankly, I hope are going to be changed. I've outlined them in a six-page document. But it's everything from we've got to have a policy that says no chokeholds. That can't be acceptable. We've got to avoid any notion that officers can shoot into crowds. That's the Betty Jones circumstance. There's a number of other things, a foot pursuit policy. I've outlined them. I encourage people to look at our website. But, great. Yeah, there's changes that need to be made.
Mr. Escalante, anything that you would change?
I don't know if I would call this a change as much as a clarification. I don't want to put a price on any of this if it's meant to be better for the city for everyone. But this does come with a significant price, and I don't think that's really been addressed properly. And where does the money come from to make sure all these changes are in place? I'll just give you one example, and this is my own research, and it's going to be a ballpark figure, but I will guarantee you I'm right in the ballpark. When you look at the section that deals with sergeants and supervision and the ratio of one sergeant for every 10 police officers, and to have that ratio in place and in effect by January 1st, 2020, to get to that ratio, to test, to promote, to train, to keep up with attrition, the addition of the salaries and the benefits, just that one section alone for the sergeants by January 1st, 2020 is, in my best guess, and again, I know I'm right there, about $35 to $40 million. That's just for that one section. And so I just think that that part needs to be relayed to the city as well to say, hey, there is going to come a cost with this. And unfortunately right now, because I'm not aware of any federal funds or state funds that are being allocated to help with this, unfortunately the citizens of the city of Chicago are going to end up paying for that whole bill. And again, in the end, if it's worth it, you know, then that's great. But there may come a time when we're going to have to stop because we just don't have money to pay for everything.
Okay, well, we have a ton of questions. So let's see if we can get to some of the questions. We're gonna give the people in the room who submitted questions the first shot, because some came from people who are not in the room. Here's one from Ed Backrack, member of the City Club. For Kevin Graham, Chicago spends the same amount for policing as Los Angeles, but LA has 45% more people and is double our size. Doesn't this show that we spend too much for policing? If you're concerned about cost, shouldn't this be addressed?
No. There's a different way of calculating some of the things that Chicago police do and some of the police things that Los Angeles does, including that many of their duties that we do are done by the sheriff in Cook County. So it's somewhat mixing apples and oranges because the county picks up some of those costs. They also have a larger ratio larger ratio of police officers to the public. And so sometimes they don't always have enough police officers for what they need to do. And they have been growing every year to try and catch up with where Chicago is. By the way, I did want to mention that if there are things in this in the consent decree, and there are several things that are good, if the city wants to put those into our collective bargaining agreement, I'm fine. There's a number of good things that I would endorse, but they have not come to us yet, and okay. We have been without a contract for more than a year.
Here's another question from Michael Bauer, another member. If you agree that CPD has a credibility problem in communities of color, do you think that a consent decree will help mitigate that issue? Any of you that are willing to take that one?
I'm certainly willing to.
The answer is it depends. It really, again, goes back to whether or not there's a commitment on the part of the mayor and the superintendent to make sure that they're doing everything that needs to be done to really bridge the divide. And there's lots of things that we can do. We can borrow from other cities, but we haven't done that. I'll give you one example, let me give you the context. Unfortunately, we remain one of the most segregated cities in the country. We recruit from those segregated neighborhoods. If you go over to the academy on West Jackson, what you're going to see in either a recruit class or a promotion class is that they've self-segregated themselves by race. Race matters in policing, and we've got to do a much better job of dealing with the realities of overt racism and the implicit biases that all of us have growing up in different circumstances. One of the things that New York does, which I've urged the department to do here, is before a recruit goes out on his assignment, 2 weeks or more before that happens, he goes out into the community in the daylight hours, not on the midnight shift, but on the daylight hours, and meets with community ambassadors. That helps demystify those neighborhoods. It provides the recruit with a network of context within that community, and frankly demonstrates that even in the most economically distressed or crime-plagued neighborhoods, that there are people of goodwill there that want the same things for themselves and their families like everybody else. We should be doing that here in Chicago. If we don't do those kinds of things, again, the paper is the paper, but it's the execution and what the practices on the ground are going to be that are going to make the real difference.
Okay. Let's take another question. This one is from Mark Loveless to Mr. Graham. Have you considered that for the FOP to never admit that an officer is wrong breeds distrust? I don't know if that's a comment or a question, but it's a statement.
I guess it's a statement. So, no, we have, I think one of the things that people don't understand is people come into our office every day, and some of those we have to tell officers flat out, you're wrong. And we certainly don't advertise that, but we are certainly not perfect. However, when we see something like the Realmo case, where secret investigations are being done, and they are trying to fire somebody and not give him his due process, that's a problem. And certainly we stand up and we go after the city, we go after COPPA, and who's ever trying to take the rights away from anyone. I think that we also don't get enough credit as to what we do and try and promote our harmony in the community. We're the ones that promote and publish a whole page on what to do if you're stopped by the police. And those are funds from the officers' money that they put up to try and help us bridge gaps in the community. So the idea of us not admitting when people do things wrong, that's not true. That's just not true.
Candidate Lightfoot, Randall Blakely, his question is, given the role that moral transparency must play in the provision of quality and mutual community policing, why do you believe there's such a staunch resistance to documenting whenever officers have to draw their gun?
Well, hopefully that ship has now sailed. When you think about it, the officers have to document various uses of forces in writing since the early 2000s. What we're talking about here is when an officer believes that there is a need not just to unholster their weapon, but to take their weapon and point it at an individual with the prospect of using deadly force. That's something that clearly should be documented. It's a very significant, if any of you had a gun pulled on you, as I have, that's a very significant event in the citizen's life, but also, frankly, from a pure risk management standpoint, not having documentation of that when there's an incident that may come, and particularly a lawsuit, exposes the city to liability. There's a whole checkbox of things that must be done when force is used. This is, frankly, a matter of simply adding a checkbox to a piece of paper. And the notion that somehow officers will that will provide a disincentive for them to pull their gun when their life is in danger or the life of another, I just think that that's nonsense. Having spent a lot of time around officers and talking to them about issues related to police-involved shootings, I don't see that as a disincentive. We document in the department paint transfers when there's a car crash. Does that provide a disincentive for officers to get in their cars and do their job? No. And the notion that they're not going to pull their gun and point it when necessary, that just makes no sense to me.
Can we have Mr. Escalante and Mr. Graham respond to that question as well?
You know, I really want to respond to that. Certainly there is a hesitant. We have an officer right now who has suffered serious brain injury. She was afraid to pull her gun, and her exact comments were, I don't want to be the next police officer accused of shooting somebody unnecessarily. She will never return to the job. She is at home and probably will be in her home for the rest of her life.
Okay.
I don't think you see the officers that come in with their serious injuries. And if you put yourself in my spot for a minute, I think you'd see something very different. And I certainly don't want to see officers killed because they're hesitant.
Mr. Escalante?
So I would say if that data is going to be collected and officers, when they point their weapon at an individual, if that's going to be documented, that data can't be examined strictly by looking at how many times did Officer A pull his duty weapon in the 11th District on the west side versus Officer B, who's working around the zoo at Lincoln Park. You're going to have to look at what types of calls they were responding to, and a lot of other factors are going to have to be taken into consideration. If somehow or another the city is going to use that as a measurement of maybe an early warning indicator, you really have to look at the totality of the circumstances each time the weapon is pulled, and not, it can't just be a matter of Officer A pulled his gun 32 times this year and Officer B over in Lincoln Park, zero.
Okay. Here's a question from Bob Bartlett for Lori Lightfoot. Throughout your career, a mountain of evidence has emerged regarding corruption and the wrongful conviction movement, yet you've said little or nothing about this evidence. Why not?
Well, that's actually not true. And frankly, one of my last cases at Mayor Brown was representing an individual who spent 20 years in prison for a murder, an attempt murder that he didn't commit. So facts do matter. These are big issues, and I've been very outspoken, frankly, about the fact, from a city perspective, that you have these post-conviction petitions that languish for years in the civil section of Cook County with the state's attorney's office, and the city sits back and does nothing. And then by the time the federal case is filed, when the person's been exonerated, they don't want to negotiate. All they want to know is how much money are they going to get from the city. So I think there's a real role for the city to step up and be much more proactive in addressing these issues. We've gone through the Burge era. We're about to go through the Guevara era. Ray Guevara, if you haven't heard about him, Google him. He's an officer who now has taken five and refused to testify in cases where individuals have alleged wrongful conviction. And unfortunately, we're going to be paying for that for years to come. So. Okay. Facts do matter. I've actually been very outspoken in this issue.
I'd like to make a comment on that. First of all, I think you should probably take a look at the Anthony Porter case and Mr. Protest from Northwestern, who they found was untruthful. And I think the city paid out on that, and they shouldn't have. I mean, that's part of the problem. The other problem is that you cannot bring in detectives who have been retired for 20 years and expect them in their late 70s and 80s to start remembering cases. I mean, it's ridiculous. There was a trial. There was a trial that took place, and now you want to try and have another bite at the apple.
Okay. Well, we're winding down time. 1 minute for each of you. Closing comment that you might have. Let's start with Mr. Graham.
With me. I've dedicated my life to try and provide a safe place for people to live, and I have certainly done my job to the city of Chicago, along with the 12,000 other police officers that live and work here. We need to have a collaborative effort to try and resolve these issues. We need to sit down and talk about those things. This is an election year, and unfortunately, a lot of this has to do with politics and less to do with law enforcement. I have always been willing to try and resolve these matters, and I have done so with talking with the superintendent a number of times, who's been very open to listening to our ideas.
Okay. Ms. Lightfoot?
Well, I think this whole conversation is important, and I want to thank the City Club for organizing this panel. We are living in a very challenging time in our city because we are facing a public health crisis regarding violence, and we've got to treat it like that. And we've got to come up, I think, with concrete solutions, and one of them, obviously, in my belief, is the consent decree. If we get it right and we actually do what needs to be done to make the kind of systemic change in our police department that's necessary to restore faith in our communities and make sure that we are providing the resources and support that our officers need to be successful in their mission, then we will have done a great thing for our city for years to come. When I think about these issues, I think about the children in way too many neighborhoods across our city who grow up with fear as their norm. We have to get these issues right for them.
Okay. Mr. Scalante.
Well, I guess I'll just close by saying I spent 30 years with the Chicago Police Department, and I look back at those 30 years, and I'm proud of the people that I served with. Certainly, we are made up of 12,000 individual persons who collectively make up the Chicago Police Department, and we are humans, so there are times that we make mistakes. That's in any profession, but certainly it's in any police agency. But the vast majority of the men and women in the Chicago Police Department do the job right, or they try to do the job right. And Lori mentioned a couple names that, yes, those are the names, unfortunately, people associate with the Chicago Police Department, but that's the small percentage. And so I would just remind everyone here to keep that in mind, that the vast majority of the men and women in the Chicago Police Department do the job right, and they try to do the job right. And those that don't, I understand Superintendent Eddie Johnson is going to hold those accountable as well as he should. But the vast majority of the men and women are doing it right.
You know, the one thing we all have in common, we all have in common, is that we want to go out and come home alive.
That's right.
Policemen, citizens, everybody wants the same thing, ultimately. So why don't you give them a round of applause? And one final comment. There were 1,700 public comments when it was open for the consent decree. Another opportunity may come when Judge Dow may open up for written comments and hearings on the 24th and 25th of October. So, you know, out of 3 million people, 1,700 comments. I submitted my comments. So I would encourage all of you to do the same. Let your voice be heard, and thank you so much.